From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Research suggests that the human appetite for seafood could decimate the world's fisheries in 3 decades if we don't change our ways. What can consumers do to be part of the solution? We hear from TJ Tate, director of the National Aquarium's Sustainable Seafood Program, about fish you can buy with a clear conscience. Then Beth Lowell of the nonprofit conservation group Oceana joins us to talk about seafood fraud. She shares tips for getting the fish you think you're getting.
Buy as close to the whole fish as possible. The more processing that's happened to a piece of fish, like the skin, the fin, the heads all removed, the better opportunity for seafood fraud to happen.
It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Today we're talking about seafood and how to make environmentally friendly choices at the grocery store. In recent decades, many species of ocean fish have been reduced to a fraction of their original numbers, and some fisheries have collapsed entirely. Research suggests that if the world keeps fishing at the current pace, in 30 years, there will be little to no seafood left to harvest. What can consumers do to be part of the solution? TJ Tate, director of the National Aquarium's Sustainable Seafood Program, is with me in the studio to tell us. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much for having me.
Even for a conscientious shopper who cares about how their purchases affect the environment, shopping for seafood can be confusing. Is there a simple rule of thumb like there seems to be when you're shopping for produce?
Seafood is the first thing I would say is not simple. It's not simple. I've been in the industry for 15 years, and we worked really hard to try to make it simple. And instead, I think we've confused a lot of consumers. But I always tell people, look local first. And then after local, look domestic, so that you're looking at the product from the U.S., because the U.S. fisheries are the best managed fisheries anywhere in the world.
Are wild-caught fish better in some cases, and farm fish better in other cases?
Yes, we have to have a balance between what we eat, between wild-caught and farm-caught. We don't want all of one or all of the other.
Why not?
We have been fishing our oceans for hundreds and hundreds of years. If we were just to stop fishing, just cut it off, the oceans wouldn't know how to balance itself out. The ecosystems have adapted. That's why there are management plans. There are ways to manage with the way that we fish, with the gear that we have, with the technology that we use. And some of the wild-caught fish is the best fish you will ever eat in your entire life, especially when you're thinking about a red snapper or salmon. There are some delicious species that are so good for you as well as great for the ocean. We just have to have that balance of management. But then on the flip side, aquaculture can do the same thing because science really is involved in aquaculture now. It is the only fish you can say that you know what goes into it from the second it's even an egg to the second that it ends up on your plate. You know where it was grown, the water that it was in, how it was harvested, what it was fed, how it got to you. You can know every single thing about that fish.
So are there some types of fish where you should only look for something that's been farmed, for something that comes from aquaculture?
In some of our species that we are trying to help rebound some of the populations, you know, we have some concerns over cod, for example. Well, there are other options that you can choose. Cod is a white flaky fish. There are lots of white flaky fish that you can substitute in a recipe. You need to go, when you go into your grocery store, and that's why I say ask local, is there something, can we substitute for a striped bass? Which we all know and love here in the state of Maryland, or rockfish, it's fabulous. Can we substitute for that? And for aquaculture, that's where I started my career, was growing white sea bass and striped bass out in California. And that was really one of the first times I tried the best seafood of my life, and it was aquaculture striped bass. It's something that can fit into almost any recipe, and you can feel sure that it's grown in a healthy, environmentally friendly way.
You mentioned your work in aquaculture. It's a big part of your role at the aquarium. Tell us about it.
Well, we've spent the last year and a half really looking at the seafood industry to figure out where the gaps are. What could we, as a national aquarium, 35 years old, 1.3 million visitors that come through annually, and a very large reach, you know, a trusted source, where was that gap that we could fill? And it was aquaculture, because consumers still have a negative perception about aquaculture. And if we're going to feed our world at the continuing rate that it's growing, we have to start including aquaculture fish into our diets.
So would you advocate that consumers should be happy with any farm-raised version of a fish? Or are there some types of fish where it makes sense that they prefer the wild? You mentioned wild salmon.
There are some eco-labels that people look to. They look to the Aquaculture Stewardship Council or the BAP, which is Best Aquaculture Practices. Some people, that makes them feel good to have a label on things. Domestic aquaculture in the U.S. is just like the wild fisheries. It's the best managed of any fish or protein, seafood-wise, that you're going to get. So I say look domestic because the standards are as high as you can get.
So when I have read about salmon farms that they could be environmentally devastating, you're saying that's not true of domestic salmon farms?
If you were to ask me where I'm going to eat my salmon from, of course I'm going to say wild salmon's my favorite. I have a lot of friends who are salmon fishermen, and it doesn't get any better. But then when you look at where that wild salmon comes from, most of it came from a hatchery because it started as a hatchery and they're replenishing the stocks in the ocean. So they're growing it in a hatchery, putting it back out in the ocean so then the fishermen can actually catch it once it's gotten to its size to be caught and enjoyed and eaten. But there are salmon farms that are fabulous. If you look to Canada, I wouldn't hesitate in the least bit to say that I would eat salmon from Canada. If you look to Norwegian, perhaps Chilean, I wouldn't hesitate. Those farms are about as eco-friendly as you can get when it comes to their fish feed, their water quality, their environmental standards, their systems of checks and balances. It's salmon that a consumer can definitely feel good about.
That's T.J. Tate here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. T.J. Tate directs the National Aquarium Sustainable Seafood Program. What is the best way for a consumer to get smart about the kind of distinction you just made? How would I, as a consumer with limited time to put into making choices, know that Chile and Norway and Canada are okay. places and other countries might not be?
That's a great question, and we are working on helping solve that answer. We are working with retailers, food service providers, restaurants, and we're finding out from them what their consumers are asking. What are they concerned about? So that we can figure out, as the National Aquarium, how we can help you. Is it something as simple as a flag on an app? Let's say that you walk into a grocery store that has an app, and you always have that app on because it has coupons. And if we ping you when you're shopping on that app and it says, we have the freshest aquaculture shrimp from South Carolina, come check it out. We're doing a tasting right now. You know, what are the odds that you're going to go over and taste that and then probably purchase that? So we're doing some of those tests. We don't want to just put out information because people get 5,000 information pings a day that somehow bombard our brain. So we're asking those questions and trying to put out the right answers to help you.
Are there species that are generally and ecologically friendly, safe bet?
Well, I've talked about red snapper a lot, so I'm always going to eat red snapper. And I'm always going to eat rockfish. And I'm always going to eat hybrid striped bass. It's fabulous, and that's a farmed fish. I'm always going to eat salmon. It's an easy serve. It's an easy sell. Here locally, we've really gotten people into blue catfish, which is an invasive species. We want to get it out of the water. It tastes fabulous. And chefs are loving it. They're buying into it. It's a tasty fish that tastes a lot like rockfish.
Shellfish, crabs, oysters, shrimp, particularly near and dear to Marylanders. Do you have any specific recommendations about those three?
I'm an oyster kind of a girl. I come from the Gulf. The oysters that come from here, I'm talking about the aquacultured oysters that are from the state of Maryland and Virginia, are amazing. And it's because of the salinity, because of the water, and because there are some really smart farmers out there who are, one, concerned about the bay, and two, concerned about the economy, and they have left great jobs to come back to what they know as home and grow oysters because they see it as such a, it's a type of heritage for the bay, and they're fabulous.
Shrimp seems to have a lot of baggage. In 2015, the AP did an expose on slavery in the shrimp industry. There seems to be environmental problems with both farmed and wild shrimp. True?
Shrimp is a slippery slope. And what I can say is I'm going to go back to domestic because I've worked with a lot of shrimpers in the Gulf of Mexico who are working very hard to do things the right way. And on the aquaculture side, there are shrimp farmers that are popping up all over the United States. There are two southern ladies who I personally can't wait to go down and meet. They're in South Carolina, and they know there's a shortage of shrimp, and they want to grow shrimp so that they can control it. And so they're growing it. And they see it as it's their right. It's their heritage. They grew up in the South. They want to eat their shrimp, but they want to know it's healthy, and they want to know that it's grown in the right way. So I would say as many negatives as you hear about shrimp, if you look at the domestic scene, there are 10 times more positives.
Thank you for this conversation. Thanks.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to talk seafood, aquaculture, any day.
TJ Tate is director of the National Aquarium's Sustainable Seafood Program. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break, and when we come back, a deep dive into another aspect of this complex topic, seafood fraud. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about seafood and environmental sustainability. Before the break, we heard from TJ Tate of the National Aquarium about how to make wise choices at the grocery store. Now we turn to a related topic, seafood fraud. Last year, the nonprofit called Oceana reviewed DNA testing of more than 25,000 samples of seafood. They found that 1 in 5 was an entirely different fish than the label said. Oceana campaign director Beth Lowell joins us by phone to explain the problem. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What is seafood fraud? Who is responsible for it?
So seafood fraud is any way that your seafood is misrepresented. It can be that too much ice is on the fish, so it's short-weighted, so you're not getting as much as you're paying for. Or it could be one fish is swapped out for another, or, for example, transshipping between countries to avoid tariffs for imported seafood. What Oceana focused on is that species substitution, swapping one fish for another. So the package or the menu will say one fish, but what you're getting is really something different.
And presumably, for the most part, this is someone substituting a less valuable fish.
Exactly. A lot of times what we're finding is the seafood fraud for economic motivations. In our study that you had mentioned, we took a global review of all published studies around the world, including from academic researchers, other nonprofits like Oceana, governments, and we looked at these studies that looked at 25,000 samples around the world. Of those studies, 65% of the times that species were swapped out were for the economic motivation, where you're really pulling a bait and switch somewhere in the supply chain and somebody's ripping somebody off.
What other motivation is there?
So other reasons why seafood can be mislabeled includes also giving illegally caught fish a new identity. So around the world, including in the U.S., there's fisheries laws and regulations that tell you what fish you can catch at what time and what place using which fishing gear. And so by mislabeling seafood, you can give a legal identity to some of that catch. We've also found substitutions just, you know, in more abundant species versus a lower abundant species. So if it's a time of year, you might be able to get more farm salmon than wild salmon and might make that swap out. We've also seen impacts of seafood fraud on public health. The Food and Drug Administration tells people to avoid four types of fish altogether, not limit, just avoid altogether if you're a pregnant woman or a child because of mercury contamination. And we found some of those do not eat fish sold as safer alternatives. So, you know, it runs from health reasons, economic, consumer, as well as conservation reasons that we've found seafood mislabeled, both within the U.S. and then looking at studies from around the world.
Well, I gather part of the problem, or maybe a related problem, is that the same fish has different names. And why is the name of the fish important?
Yeah, you know, that is a challenge in the United States. What we have is acceptable market names, they're called. So you could have a number of fish can all be called snapper or grouper, which makes it a challenge for a consumer to actually know what they're buying, which is one of the reasons why Oceana has been pushing that consumers have the right to know more about the seafood they eat, including what fish they're actually getting and where it was caught and how it was caught, because it's really hard to make an informed decision about either sustainability, health, economic, for any reasons without actually knowing that. The Food and Drug Administration keeps a seafood list, which gives guidance on how seafood can be labeled in the United States. That seafood list contains the Latin scientific name, the common name, as well as the acceptable market name. So many of these types of seafood that are all lumped together under one acceptable market name have English common names that could be used on the label so people have an idea of what fish they're actually eating.
Well, because of confusion in names, is it possible that some of the mislabeling that Oceana has found is unintentional?
Well, it's possible. Some of the economics behind it make it unlikely. For example, selling farmed Atlantic salmon as wild salmon. Wild salmon gets a much higher price through all levels of the supply chain than farmed salmon. So selling an Atlantic salmon as a wild Pacific salmon, like a king salmon, that was not a mistake. Or selling tilapia as red snapper is also not a mistake that happened because of confusion. The way we deal with seafood and the way that fish is caught around the world, that specific information about that fish is reported when the fish is landed, because you have to know whether the fish was caught in a legal fishery, and those are managed by what type of fish they are. So we want that information, what fish it is, where it was caught, how it was caught, to follow that fish through the supply chain, to have that information track along with the seafood. It's called traceability. So anywhere in the supply chain, it'll be harder to make that bait and switch. And then as well as giving consumers that specific information that's also following along with the supply chain of what fish it actually is, where it was caught, and how it was caught.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Beth Lowell, campaign director for the nonprofit ocean conservation organization Oceana. We're talking about the problem of mislabeled seafood, known as seafood fraud. I want to ask you about traceability, but let me zoom out and ask you, you know, sort of the threshold question. Why is seafood fraud a problem? I mean, if consumers can't tell the difference, why does it matter?
So seafood fraud is a real problem because it can impact people's health if they're trying to avoid certain species, whether it's for contaminants like mercury, allergens, or even trying to avoid antibiotics in farm seafood. It rips people off, so they're thinking that they're getting a high-value fish and really getting a lower-cost alternative. And then also it can impact ocean conservation, so giving illegally caught fish a legal identity, as well as, you know, if you're looking at something like a wallet card, which, you know, like the Seafood Watch program from the Monterey Bay Aquarium uses, it tells you whether fish are on the red, yellow, or green list, green being the most sustainably caught, red the ones to avoid. In some cases, the same type of fish is on each one of those lists, and what's dependent on whether they're red or green or yellow is where it was caught and how it was caught. So we've also seen these substitutions where a less sustainably caught fish is sold as a more sustainable option, we think to get more market access to some of the restaurants and grocery chains that are requiring that the seafood that they sell be more sustainable.
So you laid out Oceana's goal of traceability, to know what fish was harvested and how it was caught or how it was farmed. How far are we from that goal?
Well, you know, I think we're not as far as it may seem. Right now, the new regulations are in place to require a first phase of a traceability program in the United States. The Seafood Import Monitoring Program, final regulations, went through in December and will become effective or in place January of 2018. This will require some priority species that are at risk of seafood fraud and illegal fishing to supply documentation before they enter the U.S. of that basic information, where, when, how it was caught, as well as the chain of custody, the path from the fishing boat or farm to the U.S. border. This is a first phase. It's not as much as what Oceana thinks we need. We think we need to have that full traceability, not only from boat to border, but also through the U.S. supply chain to the end dinner plate. But it's a great first step forward, and the intent of the program is to expand over time. So that's a great indication that we're on the path to fighting illegal fishing and seafood fraud. Secondly, there are companies already in the U.S. that are doing this, that are tracing and requiring traceability of the seafood they sell. Retailers like Wegmans and Whole Foods require traceability for their seafood. So it's already happening, and these regulations are trying to make those that are not leaders in traceability bring them up to speed as well.
Is fraud more prevalent with imported seafood?
The seafood supply chain can be very long and very complex, as well as very opaque. So the more times the fish changes hands and changes borders, the more opportunity for seafood fraud. So, you know, there is concern that imported seafood is mislabeled, as well as U.S. fishermen are already required to report this catch information of where and when they caught it, what fish it is, the date of catch, their permit information, that we can verify that was legally caught. We don't currently require that of imports, and this rule is a way that can level the playing field of what's required of imported fish and domestic, so really bring those imports up to the same standard that our domestically caught fish already has to comply with. So hopefully with this documentation requirement, we'll see a reduction in seafood fraud of those species covered by the rule.
So these regulations, the Seafood Import Monitoring Program, just finalized very near the end of the Obama administration, actually go into effect January 2018. Do you have any sense of what will happen to the Seafood Import Monitoring Program under the Trump administration?
We really hope that it continues. This regulation was a result of the Task Force on Illegal Fishing and Seafood Fraud. It was established in 2014. Had various public comment periods to identify what the goals and the action plan and the final recommendations of the task force would be. They had 15 different recommendations, including seafood traceability. This rule has gone through many different opportunities for public comment, so it was a very well commented rule, and in fact is supported by the seafood industry, consumer groups, public health groups, conservation groups, you know, businesses that are being undercut by mislabeled and illegal seafood. So we think that the rule will continue to go on because it not only helps the oceans, but helps the fishing industry as well as consumers and beyond.
In the meantime, is there any way for the average consumer without a DNA testing kit to know if she's buying what she thinks she's buying?
You know, the best advice for consumers now is to ask questions. When you're at a restaurant or grocery store, ask at the fish counter what fish it is, where was this caught? And, you know, if you don't get a good answer, then you might want to pick something else. As well as buy as close to the whole fish as possible. The more processing that's happened to a piece of fish, like the skin, the fin, the heads all removed, cut into fillets, they're really nondescript, the better opportunity for seafood fraud to happen. And then also look for that traceable seafood. It's being sold now in grocery stores around the country that tell you more information about that fish. It might have a QR code or a barcode that you can enter the number and find the story of that fish. And then finally, I mean, I think this is probably for many products. If the price is too good to be true, it probably is. And you might not be actually paying for what you think you're getting.
Speaking of close to home, crabs are big in Maryland. Any particular advice for avoiding fraud when buying crabs?
Yeah, so we did a study on crab cake mislabeling about a year and a half ago, I believe. And we did find a high level of mislabeling of crabs. And so it's really, again, it's asking those questions. Maryland style, of course, does not mean Maryland crab. It just means it might have Maryland style seasoning in it. So ask questions. You're more likely to get a real Maryland crab if you get a whole crab rather than a crab cake.
Thanks so much for talking to us about this.
Of course.
Beth Lowell is campaign director for the International Ocean Conservation and Advocacy Organization, Oceana. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Very glad you're with us today. Hope you'll be back tomorrow.